The Books That Made Me, with Claire Armitstead.
I've come to see the poet and writer Michael Rosen.
How handy to have your own private alleyway.
He's known to generations of children for classics such as We're Going on a Bear Hunt and the Michael Rosen Book of Nonsense. He's also a broadcaster and a much-loved performance poet. And he lives on a leafy street in the London borough of Hackney, a stone's throw from where his grandparents once lived.
It was a coach house, actually. That side were the horses. That side, I think, someone once told me it was the mayor of Hackney's coach, but I don't know. And up there, presumably someone that we could call the ostler.
And the horses are turned into books, of course.
Yeah, books that side, junk that side, and up there I'm the ostler.
Up the spiral staircase, which looks rather scary.
It is. You'll be able to manage it, though, if that's what you want to do.
I've come to see what the books are that made him.
I have selected some books. But much too many, though, because most of the kiddies ones. Okay, let's get some chairs together and then we'll sort ourselves out.
Is this a particularly important room to you?
Yeah, well, this building, it's done several things for me. It's been a library, it's been a study, it's actually been a place where I've lived for a while when certain separations took place in my life. It's also where my son has lived with his girlfriend and his some of his stuff there, you see. Look, he hasn't actually quite moved out yet.
So have you written some of the books that we might all have read here in this very space?
Yes, I think so. I think I've written quite a few. There's the sort of old dying computer there and a newer one over there. What have I written here? I think the Book of Nonsense that you mentioned. I think I've written mostly there. Not Bear Hunt, I don't think, because I didn't really write Bear Hunt.
Well, what do you mean you didn't write Bear Hunt?
It's a folk song. It's an American folk song. It goes, we're going on a bear hunt, we're going to catch a big one. So I adapted it. Well, what happened was I was performing it. I was performing it just as I like to perform my own stuff. And an editor, the chief editor at Walker Books saw it, and he said, that will make a good book. So I said, well, go on then, you make it into a book. And he said, what do you mean? You were doing it. I said, well, it's all right, it belongs to anybody. It's like Barbara Allen or God Save the Queen. It belongs to everybody, it's all right. He said, no, you write it down. So then when I wrote it down, I could see that it wouldn't write down as a book because it was all full of noises and things. So then I had to write noises, and then it was too short, so I had to lengthen it. And then I had to come up with a slightly different ending to make it work. And then we handed it over to Helen Oxenbury. But then Helen Oxenbury made it into a story because she created those characters. So it's folk wisdom, a little bit of canny adaptation. I'll take credit for that. And Helen's genius in imagining it. And, the Brownies have been singing We're All Going on a Lion Hunt for at least 50 years. So some people are quite indignant that I ruined We're All Going on a Lion Hunt by saying we're going on a bear hunt. And they said, well, no, that came from American summer camps. So where it began, no one knows.
And maybe summer camps is something that you might talk about a little bit in this.
Yeah, well, my parents, they entered the Communist Party at the age of 16. And then something about communism and working class life somehow or other seem to interpret this as that what you have to do is go camping. Now, I don't remember Marx ever wrote about this. I don't think Marx ever said go camping. But somewhere or another in the 20th century, the early 20th century, people thought that's what you do with Marx, you go camping.
So will you take us and show us one of the books that you might have read on one of your very earliest camping holidays?
Well, not only might have, I know for certain, if we're going to start there, is that my dear father got us in the tent, pumped up the tilly lamp, as it used to be called. It's a paraffin lamp that you pump and then a little mantle glows. And we all sat round and he read us Great Expectations.
So tell us about Great Expectations, what it meant to you then.
I thought that it was like theatre. My dad was brilliant at doing voices. So I can, in a sense, I can feel the book more than read it. For example, you know, there's Uncle Pumblechook early on in the book, who's this rather preposterous, pompous person who's got sort of rather gross ideas about social mobility and education and so on. And he keeps firing these questions at Pip, the boy, who is telling the story from the vantage point of adulthood, he fires these numbers at him because he thinks he's going to improve him. So he goes, and three, and five, and nine. So my dad used to do that. He would do that as a kind of gag. But the more I find out about my dad's life, the more it was like Pip. I mean, it is a bit extraordinary, but he never really kind of indicated that. That's to say, he never knew his father. He was brought up by his mother, but his mother couldn't work. But he was actually brought up by other people other than his mother in this strange house that had 12 people in it, in a tiny sort of two up, two down type of house in the East End. So now when I read the book, and I do occasionally look back at bits of it, I haven't sat down and read the whole thing for about 10 years, is that it's sort of like, it's like a refracted version of my dad's life.
So let's bring it back to you. You've got a pile of books down there on the floor beside you. I notice Squirrel Nutkin, Beatrix Potter. You've said that most of your work is based on a version of you between the ages of 2 and 12. Which of these books is the most relevant to that now?
I go for this one, I think. Yeah, it's called The Amazing Pranks of Till Eulenspiegel. And you can see that a very small hand has ripped the cover there.
That and was your hand, was it?
Of course. And then we get over onto the next page, and that is another layer there. You'll see lots of, as a map of Germany, going up into Denmark, across to Poland, Bohemia. And there's lots of scribbling and arrows. And this is me as aged about 5 or 6. It says there, map showing the places mentioned in the wanderings of Till Eulenspiegel. And obviously I'm imagining the wanderings. But over here, May the 7th, 1949, I'm 3 years old, and it's given to me from Brian Pierce. Now, for some people, that's a very resonant name. Brian Pierce was a kind of translator of early kind of Marxist tracts. He became quite famous one way or another because he wrote about why he left the Communist Party, and he became a kind of orthodox Trotskyist and then a not-so-orthodox one. And he lived with us. He lived with us when he and his partner split up. And he had a room that was even more bookish than this. I mean, if you wonder why I'm kind of sitting in a sort of den of books, it's in partly because of having seen the way Brian Pierce lived, surrounded by kind of mouldering copies of Encyclopedia Britannica when I was about 3. So there's the book.
Who's it by, and is it?
It's not
book,
by is anybody. This is it, you see. Now, if we were in Germany, Till Eulenspiegel, he's just known as like Robin Hood is known. All right, and for a while he was known in this country. They translated it and called him Till Owlyglass. Eulen is owl, Spiegel is a mirror. And the idea is that Till, who is a trickster, holds up, and you can see here, he holds up a mirror to the world and shows their follies. And his tricks are at the expense of local tradesmen and aristocrats. So there's a kind of element of class warfare going on here, which must have been approved by Brian Pierce. There he is. But there's funny bits and sad bits. It's a lovely book.
Do you want to read a teeny bit of it?
Till came in his wanderings to another university town called Erfurt. Here once more he pasted bills to the doors of churches and colleges, proclaiming his skill and scholarship and holding forth a challenge to the masters and students of the university. The story of his doings at Prague and of how he had outwitted the learned faculties there had reached the town before him, and therefore the masters and professors of Erfurt, who did not want to be fooled by his wiles, put their heads together in long and earnest consultation. They meant to find a task for Till which he would not be able to perform, and in the end they hit upon a plan by which they felt certain of defeating his boastful challenge. They sent him a letter, which ran as follows. Great and learned Master Till, we welcome you to our midst. Inasmuch as you have made it known that you are so great and skillful a master that there exists no pupil whom you cannot teach, we have decided to put your abilities to the test and desire you to accept a pupil of our choosing, whom you shall teach to read. Are you prepared to agree to this?
You grew past 12 eventually. Tell us about your
teenage
years.
That can be debated, but yes, teenage years.
You acted, among other things.
Yes, that's right. I joined Questers. Questers is a sort of semi-pro theatre in Ealing. And at the time, I don't know what it's like now, but it was very, very intense. It was kind of Stanislavski. And, you know, you had to read Stanislavski. And I remember the very first session I went to, we all sat round in a group, and a rather grand lady, as I remember her, said that we were each to do a mime, and we had a piece of paper, and you had to go away and practice your mime and then bring it back to the group. And mine was peel an apple. Okay? So I sat down and I mimed peeling an apple. And people said peeling a potato. You see, and she said, do you know why they're saying peeling a potato, Michael, and not peeling an apple? And I said, no. And she said, because you haven't indicated the roundness of the apple. People could just see your right hand doing a peeling motion, but they couldn't see the roundness of the apple. And that was my first acting session.
Is there a book that you associate with that period that we can have as your third book?
I might just have to go and look for that. Yes, it's a play that we did.
Gosh, it looks like library stuff.
Yeah, rolling bookcases that you must have to be very careful that you don't trap anybody, a small human being, in between them, because they would be squashed into books like dried flowers. Maybe one day I'll kind of open one of them and find one of my children in there squashed. No, that's awful. Let's just do a little windy bit and find the drama section.
We've got a script here, an ancient script, yellowing
yes.
script, with annotations, I notice, in pen.
Yes, absolutely. The Visit, it's like, it's very hard to describe it because English drama doesn't really have this tradition. It's like an expressionist folktale. It's by Friedrich Dürrenmatt. And really, it's a moral tale of the fact that the West Germans took the penny, took the money from America, but it's told in a very sort of folk-styly way for some of it as a morality tale, but other moments of it are a bit like kind of expressionist drama, like somebody like Maurice Maeterlinck's. And the lead was taken by Dinah Quick.
This is at Oxford?
This is at Oxford, and I was one of her sort of slave boys. I was, you know, think kind of Madonna, really, and I was sort of one of the sort of slave boys who was called, well, they translated it as Bobby, but I think in the original German he tends to get pronounced Bobby, I think, anyway. I played it as a cranky old geezer. I'd found these weird sunglasses. I picked them up in Paris because it's all rather exotic. She's not real. I mean, she's like a sort of Marilyn Monroe Dowager Duchess figure. You know, she's both glamorous but old. There we are. It says, cross his centre. He takes off his dark glasses and turns his face with a solemn air. Does anyone here present recognise me? And that was my opening line, you see. And
although you went up to read medicine originally.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, when I was about 16, we'd finished O-levels, and I'd sort of made the fatal error of saying to my dad that I'd quite liked doing biology. And he instantly interpreted that as me wanting to be a doctor. And so he rushed me around to see his old friend Chick from the East End. That was a nickname. And they worked out how I could do Arts A-levels and then do this thing called First MB. I don't even know whether you can do it anymore, which is like the equivalent of Science A-levels at Middlesex Hospital. And then go on and do Second MB and then all the other stuff, you know, all the medical stuff. And they worked it all out. And I kind of sat there thinking, oh, well, this is quite nice. I don't know why I thought it was quite nice, but I did. Maybe it was something to do with having seen Jonathan Miller in Beyond the Fringe. And so, yeah, I found myself, aged 18, in the middle of the Middlesex Hospital Medical School, having done English, French and history in the sixth form, and really loving it all. And there I was, chopping up rats and trying to understand spectroscopy and Young's modulus and things like that. And I was very, very uncomfortable about it all. And I tried to get out of it by various methods. And then in the end, I came up with a ruse that I thought was, in those days, it was very, very difficult to switch courses in London. But I had heard from my brother who got into Oxford to do geology that it was possible to change course a bit more easily there. So I thought that maybe if I wangled my way in there, I could then change, almost as it were, without my dad knowing or something. I mean, it's a bit mad, but anyway. So that's what I did. And I then had to do the first year of a degree in physiology. So, yeah, I got out of it. So that's how I got back, in a way, to doing English.
So going back to the books that made me, your fourth choice, do you have a book particularly associated with that period of your life, your student period?
From that period, perhaps I could take one. This doesn't sound very romantic and exciting. But one of the things about that time was that it was turmoil and it was very exciting. So if a book comes out that's called The Military-Industrial Complex, you didn't think that that was something dull. That of itself appeared wonderful and amazing, that somebody could look at politics and reveal things. It's a bit difficult to describe because, you know, in the present context, that's what people do all the time. You know, people are always uncovering things and exposing things. But at that time, sort of in the 60s, it did really feel like kind of almost maybe like explorers did. And someone once said to me, you want to get this book, it's called The Military-Industrial Complex by Sidney Lenz. And that's spelt just like the lens that you got in your eye. And as you can see, you know, there it is, all marked up with the pen. Just over and over again, there were just bits that just stunned me about how much business and the military were intertwined in America. And this was at the height of the Vietnam War. You know, there's a wonderful bit here, I remember. I mean, this is totally predicting. So after the war, Albert Einstein observed that the unleashed power of the atom has changed everything except our way of thinking. Thus, we're drifting toward a catastrophe beyond conception. The atom bomb beguiled Americans into believing that military power was their shield, when in fact military power no longer effectively serves political strategy. For the first time in history, it's impossible to win a total war, and it's increasingly difficult even for great powers to win limited small ones.
Yes, that actually is pretty relevant today.
Absolutely. People think that, you know, all that stuff, all that kind of apocalypse stuff that we went on about, you know, nuclear weapons. Well, I mean, in a way, the apocalypse hasn't gone away. It is always there. You don't need some nutter to press the button, whoever it is. But it's the idea that you can win small wars. And, of course, they can't. You know, he wrote that. Well, it was first published in 1971 in Britain, 70 in the States. So there he was looking at it. And here we are 40 years later. And we're looking at two wars, very clearly not one. Awful catastrophe, even as we're speaking now, happening in Iraq. And the constant nightmare of Afghanistan, which, you know, is just totally either not solvable or very unlikely to be solved. Mm. I mean, and all the aims of the idea that it's going to make us safer, quite clearly exactly the opposite.
So do you still read books like this?
Yes, all the time.
So we think of you as somebody who you know, talks about funny things and reads funny things and relates to children, but actually you're relating to very serious political stuff as well.
Yes, and I also read a lot of history. I'm reading just this week. I sometimes read things in French. So here, for example, something I'm very, very interested in is France during the Second World War. So this is called Le STO, Pendant la Seconde Guerre Mondiale. The STO, as we'd say in English, is the Service du Travail Obligatoire.
That sounds very serious. Do you want to have this as your next book?
Well, we could do as we're on it. Yes, I know it's right of now, but it sort of connects with family in a way as well.
They're very international, your choices, aren't they? I've noticed there's a lot of Germany. Here we've got France, we've got Russia.
Well, that's just the way I see things. I'm always kind of disturbed by the way in which people see things purely in terms of either England or Britain. Jews were sometimes described as rootless cosmopolitans. I think it was possibly Stalin who called us that. But in a way, I'm sort of proud to be a rootless cosmopolitan. That's not to say you have no roots, so it's not strictly true. I'd describe myself as a rooted cosmopolitan, perhaps. So roots in lots of different places.
So tell us about you, where your fascination with France came from. You as a teenager learnt to speak French on French holidays with your parents.
And also I kind of went to a French camp as well. I mean, it's another...
So you camped all over Europe.
Yes, but what happened was once we were camping in a place in the Ardèche and it was just by then my brother had gone off and so I'm about 15 and every day I'd go off and swim in the river. And there were these kids there. And then after about a couple of weeks, my dad said, well, would you like to go and stay with them? And I said, OK, yeah, all right. And so it turned out it was what French call a colony de vacances, what we would call summer camp, or kids' youth camp. And so they said, yeah, OK. So I went and stayed with them for 10 days. And I was the only English kid. And they were all sons and daughters of workers at a big chemical works in Lyon called Gerland. And so I got to know them. And then... in the bit in between, my dad said, well, would you like to go there again? So the next summer, the camp had moved a bit, and I stayed for 6 weeks on my own, the only English kid there, making out as much as I could, and learning a kind of sort of adolescent grunting French, which, of course, once it's in your head, it's very difficult to kind of rid it. So if you're standing talking to somebody in France, you know, this kind of French
old-fashioned teenage
speak kind of comes to mind. So I have to kind of try and get rid of it and be my age, which is always very difficult for me. Yes.
Now, we've actually come to the sixth and final book, and
right.
We've got a huge amount of your life to pack into this book, because we've talked about your family of origin, but what about the family you've made, which has obviously been really important to you? You've written a lot about it.
Yes, indeed. I mean, I don't suppose it's always like this, and perhaps you could tell me that, you know, if you treasure your own childhood, perhaps I've treasured it too much, I don't know, it does actually make it very easy to treasure your own children. I mean, there is a sort of evolutionary imperative in that, I'd have thought, but I mean, some people, they really quite dislike their own childhoods or are afraid of them or, of course, despise them, and sometimes, of course, bad things happened and they quite like to put it behind and make a new nice one for their own children. I can understand all that, but in my case, I mean, I do genuinely derive massive pleasure from my children, and love seeing the things that they do and so on. It's a bit difficult to choose, really. One of my children's called Emile. He has an E on the end, but Emile and the Detectives is one of my favourite books, but that takes me back there. But also I'm actually, of course, interested in childhood, and I teach children's literature at Birkbeck. Perhaps I could, in a funny sort of way, return to my parents here. They wrote a book. They wrote a book called The Language of Primary School Children. Which is sadly out of print. Perhaps I could grab that, because in a way it's sort of both about the past and very much about the present, because I think that the things they're saying are so totally appropriate to what is both wrong and right about education at the moment. I'll grab that. So this is kind of nepotism in reverse, isn't it, really? But anyway, they're both dead and gone, so they don't know I'm doing this.
Are those your pen markings? Again, you're very sacrilegious with books, aren't you? I notice books are scribbled in.
Absolutely. I think that's the way you make notes. You scribble in a book. Why not? What's the matter with that?
Does that not worry you? You don't have a sense that
books are
sacred things?
Yeah, absolutely sacred. But then you open it up and you find the good bits. You see?
And then you go back to the good bits.
If we go back to the good bits. So here it is, The Language of Primary School Children by Connie and Harold Rosen. You notice my mum's name comes first. And that's because it's actually the result of her researches. She basically did what Jim Rose supposedly did just recently. That's to say, collect together the wisdom of the best teaching in primary schools. So it's like a mini Plowden report as well. And she did it through what used to be called the Schools Council until that was abolished, because it was sort of too teacher friendly. And she basically looked at, you know, you could think it was done just the other day. She looked at the context of the school situation, talking, writing, comments on learning to read, and In Search of Drama. So all that thing that, you remember, the National Curriculum discovered, that, you know, there's speaking and listening, writing and reading. And there was my mum, dad, putting it together as one whole thing and looking at language. And I've read it and reread it many times, and I suppose it's sort of crucial to me. So here we go. Firstly, children have available much more linguistic competence than usually finds its way into their speech. We need then to create those situations which exert the greatest pressure on them to use their latent resources, to provide those experiences which urge them towards the widest range of language use. So they put experience at the heart of language. When you read all this stuff that comes out, it's all about, you know, you can inject this kind of language, inject that kind of language. They take the mickey out of it here by, there's a book called Talk Reform, and they say that in this book, the Gagans, the authors, supply an instance of how to move children away from restricted code and suggest the teacher might ask, let's think of a word which means the same as shiny. Now, apart from the fact that I find it difficult to do this, what is the other word for? What was inadequate about shiny in the first place? No hint is given of a context for the word, nor any explanation of why, if it means the same, it has any particular value.
Do your children read your books?
Yes, on and off. They have done at various times. My 9-year-old is quite keen on them, and also the 5-year-old, I'm afraid I have to do a turn. He's discovered that I kind of do these things, and so he would say, do the babysitter.
So he has a private performance
at
his command?
Yeah, and I just sort of think, well, like, you can't really turn him down, can you? Or he says, do the one, and I say, well, it's all right, it's on the internet, you can see me doing it. No! you know. Do the one about, and then, of course, I've run out of things. So I've got to make up new ones. So just this holiday, I've made up a story about, it's a French story about a snail called Hubert. There's Hubert the snail. There's a scarecrow who's also very good at scaring pigeons, l'épouvantail. And then there's a dragonfly, and they all keep saying the name for dragonfly in French, which is une libellule. So they keep walking around going, libellule. Anyway, they're trying to get to the seaside, and the scarecrow got stuck in the water until a dog saved them. So anyway, that's where we are with that story at the moment.
And that may one day be hitting a bookshelf near us.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, it's a bit mad and a bit scatological, of course. You know, poo does have to appear at regular points in a story.
I hear that's not a particular problem.
No, no, not these days, I guess. I suppose there's just a little bit of me thinks that that's, you know, that's for the oral stuff, but no, maybe not, you know.
So finally, absolutely yes. Finally, what is the luxury? And we know this is a bit of a steal from somewhere else that yes. People may be familiar with, but yes. Hey, what's new?
No.
What is the reading luxury you would take?
You've already
you?
Guessed it. And you've already described it several times, and I'm about to take it off you. It's a pen, so that I can scribble in the margins of the books.
That's my biro, so
it is.
Have my blue biro.
Exactly,
in your
I've nicked
of your
it off you because
book.
I never have a pen at hand. I keep going. Where's? Have you seen a pen? Of course, I'm sounding just like my dad. I can't find a pen, so I'm trying to get a pen off my children. So there it is. There's the scribble. There, the question mark. Yeah, the pen is needed. I think. To be absolutely honest, I don't scribble in poetry books.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. In fact, we didn't even choose a poetry book, did
no.
we?
No, is that
all
significant?
This.
Well,
it's
very
over
surprised.
There. It is in the... There's two over there, and
You've
we didn't get
it.
To it.
You've missed your
I
chance.
Know,
do
I've
we
missed
read
the cut.
Some, do we read some deep significance into this, that poetry didn't figure in the books that made you?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Open over there is the book that I studied, which has got D.H. Lawrence's Snake in it, which was absolutely crucial to everything. There it is, but somehow or other it got
well,
lost.
Just tell us what it's called and we'll allow you to sneak it
well,
in through the back
door. Well,
believe
it or not, it's called A Pageant of Modern Verse. There it is. It's a school textbook, but it's a wonderful little collection of modern poetry, which, you know, given that this was circa 1960, you know, there wasn't a lot of modern poetry about in schools, and somehow or other that sneaked in. And it's got great stuff in it. And I read D.H. Lawrence's Snake there, and I just thought, I could write like that. And in a way, that's one of the great things about D.H. Lawrence's poetry, is that it's very open about what it's doing. You know, it's a bit like the Great Expectations thing. He looks at himself doing things. So he looks at himself trying to kill a snake. And he thinks that he's rather petty, that he should have even tried. And this has a connection. Last summer, I killed
You killed
a snake.
One?
And so I've written a poem in reply to D.H. Lawrence's one. Yeah. So, yes,
D.H.
Lawrence.
Fine. We will have D.H. Lawrence in there. Michael Rosen, thank you very much for telling us about the books that made you.
Thank you, Claire. Thanks very much.